The Beast from the Land, the ninth talk in a series on the Book of Revelation, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 2, 2013, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 4 accompanies this talk.
We're continuing on in Revelation. We looked at the first part of chapter 13. That's part 21 in my formatted edition. That's the section that deals with the beast coming up from the sea. And I argued that that seems to be a political entity on the one hand and probably an individual on the other hand. Much like ancient Babylon, Babylon just was Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar was claimed to be a god. Most of these kingdoms that came up against Israel in the ancient world were led by a leader who claimed to be God. This appears to be no exception. That in this case, the beast is on the one hand a political entity, but it's headed up by an individual who's claiming some kind of divinity or some kind of deity. The question arose last week after we adjourned whether the beast could be Islam. And let me respond to that briefly. Back when the early Christians were, or the Christians before the Reformation were interpreting Revelation, the beast was the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope. That made all the sense in the world for them to interpret it that way at the time. The problem is a lot of history is passed under the bridge in the meantime, and the world has changed, the geopolitics has changed, the religious landscape has changed, things are really very different. If I were to bet today whether Islam could be the beast, I'd have to say yes. That seems very, very likely. The problem is we don't know when the end is coming. The end could be tomorrow, or begin tomorrow, or it could be another 1,000 years. And in 1,000 years, a lot can change. So anytime we try to specify and pin down who these characters and who these players are based on our own experience, it's going to be limited by the horizon of our own experience. There was a time when Islam wasn't even in the horizon at all. It is now, and it is a very likely candidate for the beast, some version of Islam with some Islamic leader. But if we're not at the end, then a whole lot can change, and maybe it's going to be an entirely different player that isn't even in our purview at this point. So, yeah, I don't know, but certainly Islam is aggressively and hostily anti-Christian in a way that makes it a good candidate for that. I don't think I have anything more to say about the beast here, unless you have some questions, so I can try to entertain your questions here. But we now go on to the next vision, and this is in chapter 13, verse 11, part 22 in my formatted paragraph 63. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose fatal wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, and he provides that no one will be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his name is 666. Okay, so this second vision, notice that the first beast came up out of the sea. This beast comes out of the land or out of the earth. Throughout this section, I have left it earth, as the New American Standard has it, but I think it's highly likely that we should translate it land. I think we're talking about the land of Israel here in this vision. So I saw another beast coming up out of the land of Israel, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. I think that's intended to represent that this beast, who I think is an individual human being, is a false Messiah. He's coming out of Israel. He's satanically inspired. He speaks like a dragon, but he looks like and has the appearance of who we saw earlier, Jesus, the lamb with the two horns before the throne, the only one who is qualified to break the seals on the scroll, if you remember that vision. So he looks just like Jesus, but he speaks like a dragon. So I think we are to understand this to be a false Messiah who's going to arise in Israel. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and the land, I think is highly likely, he makes the land and those who dwell on the land of Israel to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. So we have had emerge out of the Gentile nations some kind of leader who has power, apparently gains power over the whole globe eventually. He has power and claims to be divine. Along comes a prophet, a false Messiah among the Jews, telling the Jews to worship him. And how does he persuade them to do that? He seems to have supernatural ability to perform various signs that imitate, that stand for authentication that he is in fact the Messiah. So that's what the next paragraph says. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. And he deceives those who dwell in the land because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell in the land to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. Now, will he literally make an image to the beast? That's a hard call because this is Revelation. And so much in Revelation is simply symbolic. It may simply be an allusion back to Exodus, where they made images to the gods that they worshipped and served those gods as represented by their making images to them. So the false Messiah may not literally ask them or require of them that they make an image to the beast, but he does the equivalent of that. He insists that they serve this beast as God, this political leader who's gained ascendancy in the world, to worship him as God. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast. Again, that is not necessarily literal. There's not necessarily a statue of a beast, an image of the beast that has been given, has breath given to it. But it may just be symbolic of the false prophet supporting and thereby giving vitality to the beast over the people of Israel in the land. He's supporting him in such a way that the beast has life among them. On the other hand, it could be literal. I mean, I'm not ruling that out. I'm just suggesting that I don't think it would have to be literal. So that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. That, I think, is quite literal, that the authority that he will have and the goal and agenda he will have is to literally kill anyone who does not give their allegiance to the beast, whether great or small, rich or poor, free or slave. If you do not have the mark of the beast on your right hand or your forehead, then you will be marginalized socially, politically, economically, put on the outside. Now, what does it mean to have the mark on the forehead or the right hand? We've seen that before in Revelation. Who are the 144,000? They have the seal of God on their forehead. These people are being asked to have the seal of the beast on their forehead and on their right hand. It comes out of Deuteronomy, where the word of God is to be bound on your head and on your hand. And I think it represents that which you are committed to. Your actions are committed to doing what God requires if the word of God is bound on your forehead, and your thinking and your understanding is to conform to what God has revealed if the word of God is bound on your forehead. If it's the mark of the beast on your forehead and on your hand, then you are bound and committed to obeying, serving, and believing what the beast would have you do and believe. So it's just, this is the anti-God. The beast is the anti-God. And you are either serving God or you are serving the beast. You're either believing the worldview and values of God or the worldview and values of the beast. You either are practicing what God requires of you or you are practicing what the beast requires of you. And it's the false Messiah, this false prophet, who is reinforcing this in the land of Israel, I believe. Now he talks a little bit about this mark. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, notice this mark would not have to be literal in order for him to be making the point that he's making. To have the mark on the forehead or on the right hand or the forehead would simply mean that you are committed to his agenda in some way and obedient to his agenda. But he tells us what this mark consists of in the next paragraph. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. Okay. In the past, the mistake that I have made along with so many other interpreters is to think that what he's doing with this number is giving us a code for identifying who this beast is. I don't think that's right. 666 is not the identity of the beast, it's the number of the beast. Well, what have we seen how number is being used in Revelation up till now? Remember a few visions back, he was given a golden rod to go and measure the temple. And measuring the temple was discerning and finding the boundaries of God's protection. God was going to protect them, was going to protect the temple, but not the courtyard of the temple. And so he measured that part that was going to be protected, setting the boundaries of divine protection. Well, what's the number of the beast? The number of the beast is the boundaries of his domain. If the number has been discerned, then you know the limits and the boundaries of the authority of this beast. So wisdom comes from understanding, from calculating and understanding the beast's number, his boundaries, his limits. Then he tells us two things. It's the number of a man, and the number is 666. Okay, first of all, the number of a man. Well, what's the number of a man? What is the limit and domain of the beast? He's just a human being. However much he may claim to be God, he's not God, he's not divine, he's merely a human being. He is no match for God. He cannot come up against God and be victorious. He's a mere ordinary mortal who's going to die like any other mortal. So what are his boundaries? That the end of his life is the end of his life. His authority, his terror, his destruction, his opposition to God cannot persist beyond the life of a human being, a mortal human being. That's one thing. Then the second thing is his number is 666. Now we have to be a little bit careful here because In the Greek text, we don't have the Arabic numeral 666, which is part of our popular lore. It's not the number 666. It's written out in words, six hundreds, six tens, and six. Now, as it happens, I think putting it in Arabic numerals, however, actually dramatizes and highlights and gets right to the essence of what he's saying here. If the number is six hundreds, six tens, and six, it's a threefold repetition of the number six. Six, six, six. So in order to understand the symbol, I think, we have to understand the symbolism of two things. One, what's the symbolism of six? And then what's the symbolism of having it thrice repeated? Three times repeated. So let's deal with six first. I think six is to be understood in contrast to seven. Seven has been an incredibly important number and symbol throughout the book of Revelation. And I think seven largely finds its meaning in the seven-day week of the Jews. So you want a complete week, you've got 7 days. And mostly, therefore, we've seen seven being used as a symbol of fullness, completion, the full complement of something, the whole enchilada, that if you have seven, you've got everything that makes up whatever it is that's being measured or discussed. Oftentimes people describe it as a symbol of perfection, but I don't think it's perfection. It's a symbol of completion, of fullness. But there's another possibility. If seven is the number of days in a week, that week is divided into six ordinary workaday days and one special day. The seventh day is a distinctive day in the Jewish worldview, according to the covenant. You work 6 days a week, you have ordinary days and live your lives, the ordinary lives, 6 days a week. On the seventh day, you set that aside to rest from the ordinary, no longer labor, no longer strive, but rather celebrate what your labor has brought you. That's the seventh day. Then we look back and remember the very first vision that we saw in Revelation that it seems to me provides the skeleton for the whole prophecy. You had the seven seals. The first five seals were simply descriptions of ongoing, recurring events, abiding truths about the period from the first coming of Jesus to the second coming of Jesus. So famine, war, economic disruption, persecution, bloodshed, violence, that's going to be the characteristic of the period of time from Jesus' first coming to his second coming. The sixth seal was a dramatic event, the central event of Revelation, the focal point of Revelation, the great and terrible day of the Lord, or as it's described in that vision, the day of the wrath of the Lamb and the wrath of God. And that marks the end of that period from the first coming of Jesus to the second coming of Jesus, because as we will go on to see in Revelation, Jesus' return corresponds with the day of the wrath of the Lamb and the day of the wrath of God. That's one and the same set of events. But you still have another seal to come. And what's the seventh seal? I think the seventh seal is what, when we get to chapter 20, we will come to call the millennium, the 1,000 years where Jesus himself is going to rule over the world. That millennial kingdom is the seventh seal. It's like the Sabbath rest that follows all the strife and labor and work and hardship of the first six seals, which come to an end, and then there is rest. Or as the vision puts it, there is quiet. Quiet in heaven for a half an hour. So if the number of the beast is six, then it ain't seven. The number of the beast, and remember I'm using number as the limit the boundary, the measure of the beast is the establishment of his boundaries. His life, his existence, his authority, his being is limited to the six days of the week. He has no place in the seventh day of the week. He will not enter into the millennium. He will not experience the reign of Christ bringing peace to the world. That is not for the beast. To repeat it six times, I think, is a kind of a Hebraic idiom for a kind of emphasis. His limit is six. It is absolutely six. It is six without qualification. It is six. He's done. When you reach six, he's done. So it's a very dramatic way of saying, this beast is not long for this world. His authority is going to come to an end. His antagonism to the purposes of God is going to be eliminated, is going to be removed as we enter into the millennial kingdom. So herein lies wisdom, he says. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. Why is that wisdom? Because if you don't understand that, then you might very well be seduced into throwing in your lot with the beast. There's going to be a period of time where it looks like the beast is winning. It looks like maybe the beast is God. It looks like the beast is the side to be on. That's the team to join because he's the one who's prevailing. That's what it's going to look like. If you lack wisdom, you're going to serve the beast. But the one who has wisdom has calculated the number of the beast, has taken his measure, and has realized that he's a flash in the pan, that however much he may be prevailing right now, it's only a matter of time that he's going to go to his destruction and be completely eliminated. You don't want to be on his side. And as we'll see in what follows, those who do worship the beast and have received the mark have the same fate as the beast. So you don't want to be joining him. Okay, let me pause there for questions or comments.
Are you going to talk about what it would possibly look like to serve the beast? I'm thinking, I mean, there are things that we do, like we follow the laws of the land. So like, how would you compare that with render unto Caesar what is Caesar's? You know, I mean, do you think it's going to be obvious to Christians that serving the beast is the opposite of serving God?
I would think so. On the one hand, I would think so. On the other hand, I think serving the beast is not going to look a whole lot different than it does today if we allow ourselves to get seduced into thinking like the ungodly world and culture around us thinks. So their attitudes are our attitudes. Their values are our values. Their agenda is our agenda. And we just become, you know, little parrots of the values and beliefs and propaganda of the culture that we're constantly being fed. I mean, this used to be so implausible to me until the last 10 years, and I realized this is very plausible. I mean, it's happening now in a measure in American society. So what's to keep it from happening in this land, in this time, in this place? That we human beings, if we don't keep our wits about it, if we don't have wisdom, we are suckers for being conformed to the world, to the culture around us. And so it can be more subtle, but it doesn't sound like it's all that subtle here because those who don't worship the image of the beast are going to be killed. So it sounds like it's more like a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego moment. You know, bow down and worship the image to Nebuchadnezzar. No, I ain't going to do that. Well, then into the fiery furnace you go. I mean, it could very well be, and it sounds like it's probably going to be that kind of choice.
Okay. It'd be a lot easier if somebody just said, hey, come get this stamp on your hand now. And you know, yeah. You know you're supposed to say no.
Yeah. No, I think it's highly unlikely that this is literal. Of all the things that we would take as literal, I don't think this is one of them. Because you're right. I mean, that would be way too obvious. It's going to be harder than that because we're going to have to resist the pressure that the culture puts on us to think like they think, to think like the beast wants us to think. And this is a worldview and a set of moral values and a set of priorities that's coming top down from the beast. You will think like this. It's not unlike now. We have a whole class of people in American society that's trying to coerce us into a certain set of values and a certain way of thinking. So it's not unlike now, but I think by a factor of two or three, what anything we are experiencing now.
Yeah. And if we know what it's probably going to look like when Jesus actually comes back, that'll make it a lot easier not to get confused, hopefully.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Oh, if we know exactly, if we know more what it's supposed to look like when Jesus does come back, then it seems like it'll be less easy to get confused.
Yeah, I think that's the purpose. That's why Revelation was given to us, right. So that we can have, I mean, without knowing that Jesus is going to win, I think it's going to look like he isn't. And so we have to know that he's going to win to be able to persevere.
And to know, like, the difference. Because I guess I imagine that the beast might try to say he is Jesus. I mean, do you think that's possible? And so it could be really confusing.
Well, the second beast, I think, is claiming to be the Messiah. Yeah. I mean, maybe not Jesus per se, but the real Messiah. Mm-hmm. I mean, notice that in Orthodox Judaism, even when you get the Christianity out of the way and you deal with what the Bible really has to say about the Son of God, there are Orthodox Christians that Rusty has had conversation with in Jerusalem that are right there with him. Yeah, that's exactly who the Messiah is going to be. Well, do you think it's Jesus? No. No way. It's not Jesus. And one of the reasons that they have such a resistance to that is because they've read the Old Testament prophecies in such a way that the Messiah comes and establishes Revelation 20, the millennial kingdom. And they just look back at history and say, does that look like the millennial kingdom to you? And since it doesn't look like the millennial kingdom, then Jesus couldn't be the Messiah because he didn't bring in the millennial kingdom. They don't have a concept of Jesus coming once to die for the sins of the world, only to return again later to establish what the rest of the prophecies say. And conceptually, they're able to grasp that. But I went on a website once, Orthodox Jews, who said, now Christians, well, they said, why don't I believe Jesus was the Messiah? Well, look, there's no millennium on earth, and we're after Jesus, so he wasn't the Messiah. Now, Christians will tell you that he's coming twice, that he came once to die for the sins of the world, and he will come again, and then the millennial kingdom. But, and here is his knockdown, drag-out argument against that, no cigars. That's all he had to say, no cigars. You know that expression? I don't buy it. Huh. Just, I don't buy it. So their rejection of the very biblical New Testament analysis of the prophecies with regard to the Messiah is simply, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to accept that. So to the extent that that becomes hardened in their hearts, they're ready to believe in another Messiah, but they're not going to accept Jesus as that Messiah.
So the relationship between the first beast and the second beast, you said, or it sounds like there's a close alliance for the second beast being the false Messiah is telling or encouraging or whatever the verb is for the world to worship the first beast.
Or at least Israel, at least persuading Israel to worship the first beast. That the rest of the world is also serving him and worshiping him. We saw that in the last vision.
Okay.
But it may be that the second beast is only really functionally operating with respect to the Jews in Israel.
So this is where, coming back to your very first comment before we started into the study about Islam possibly being the beast, this first beast, that's where, to me, it sounds like it's a slippery slope to start predicting things like that. Because that would be a strange outcome. It's not impossible, I suppose, but it wouldn't it be a strange outcome to have the second beast having the Israelites worshiping Islam?
Yeah, you would kind of think so. Although I did read, and maybe some of you here know more than I do, about a Islamic prophecy regarding the Mahdi coming and there being a Jewish Messiah who is also, let's see, yeah, who's opposed to the false Messiah. And, I mean, it's exactly the inverse of Revelation, because as we go into the next, look at the next sentence, then I looked and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion and with him 144,000. And who are they going up in to wage war against? The Lamb. So it could very well be that what they've convinced people is that Jesus is the false Messiah. This false Messiah is the true Messiah who God has finally come into the world. And, I mean, think in terms of how secular most Jews are in the world today. Now, I don't know how to make this jibe with Orthodox Judaism, but the idea that a Muslim could be, or in the context of Islam, God could come and incarnate himself, I don't think is all that far-fetched for a lot of Jews.
That makes more sense. Yeah, if you look at it in that way, yeah.
But as I say, maybe Islam will be long gone before we even get here. I just don't know.
Jack, can I ask you something about the beast? I wasn't here last time.
Sure, yeah.
In my opinion, I think it is the Catholic Church, because the beast was wounded, and you had the Reformation.
I'm sorry, because the beast was what?
Wounded.
Oh, uh-huh.
And with the Catholic Church, you had the Reformation, which was a big thing. And then most people don't know what damage Napoleon did, because when he went around to all his different countries and so on, he completely shut down the Inquisition and, in fact, gathered all, if not all, of their papers. And the second thing, when the second beast is to come to Israel, I think there's going to have to be major, major dealing with Islam, because there's so many in Islam who think that Israel should be Palestine, should be all Jewish land.
I'm sorry, should be what?
I'm sorry, should be all Arab land, Muslim land. And then the last thing that makes me think is that all the bulls, laws, canons, so on, that the Catholic Church have made have not been taken off the books. And the Inquisition is still an organization just under a different name.
Okay. Yeah, I can't rule that out. That the only thing that we know for sure from Revelation is that it's one of the original six who controlled Israel that has been sort of reinvigorated and come back to life. So that could be Babylon, that could be Media, that could be Persia, that could be Egypt, that could be Syria, or that could be Rome. Okay. And any of those, I think, is a candidate for that.
Well, and my last argument is that the Catholic Church took in a lot of culture of Rome, which was the primary power at the time John was writing.
Okay.
That's just my two cents.
Thank you.
Yeah, with regards to how much of the earth that the first beast will control, are we just looking at the areas around Israel? Are we looking at the Middle East, or are we looking at the whole world, including the Western Hemisphere?
13:7, probably. It's my paragraph 62. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell, and then I would argue on the land, will worship him, everyone whose name is not written, and so on. So I think it's both. Revelation is focused on the Jews in Israel, but he's explicitly stating that authority has been given him over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. So I think he's going to have some kind of sway over the whole earth. Is it a one-world government? Not necessarily, because it could just be political and social hegemony over the whole world. That is, his influence is the most important influence and power over every tribe and tongue and nation and people. He just could be, I mean, we're given a picture of him in that last vision as who can, let's see how they put it, who can stand against him? Who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? So he has gained incredible power and incredible might. And that power and that might, I mean, again, look how plausible that is. Look how much America, in a sense, has ruled most of the world just through their military power over the last several decades. So it's not at all unreasonable to think that another military power could arise, especially if it's got some supernatural elements to it as well, that a power, superpower could arise who has hegemony over the whole globe. And that seems to be what's being described there. Now, let me make one other comment about, let's say that Islam is a player in this. It's more likely, it seems to me, I don't know if this is more likely or not. It's equally likely that the role Islam will play is prior to the beast and not the beast himself. If you're able to keep in mind the image that's emerging here in Revelation, remember we've already had an invasion of Israel back at the sixth trumpet. Does that ring a bell? The locust monsters, the attack of the locust monsters. The locust monsters were, through demonic seduction and deception, armies come up against Israel. Then you have the 3.5 years following that. And what I argued is that's a delay in God's judgment. The judgment began with armies invading Israel, but then God hesitates, delays, to give time for repentance before we get to the final end. Well, it may very well be that first invasion is an invasion of Muslim invaders. When you go to the book of Daniel, Daniel has two very interesting visions. One is in chapter 7, and one is the end of chapter 11 and into chapter 12. The visions there are about 10 horns, which is interpreted as 10 kings. And the 10 kings, we saw those 10 kings on the beast, right? He had 10 horns. The beast of the last chapter had 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, what did the 10 horns represent? I don't know if we haven't got there yet in Revelation, but eventually, coming up in Revelation, those 10 horns are going to be interpreted as 10 kings. Well, in Revelation, those 10 kings have a smaller horn come up that is more arrogant and more powerful than the others, and he tears out 3 of the horns, uproots them, and basically takes over. So in order to fit it into Revelation, that little horn that is a big horn may actually very well be the beast that's being described here in this chapter in Revelation. And the 10 horns were probably the armies that invaded Israel back at the sixth trumpet. So they have already conquered the land, but along after them, shortly after them, because we can't be dealing with a great deal of time here, shortly after them, there's this other unexpected power that arises who then, on the one hand, defeats some of them, and as Revelation will go on to say, the kings have granted their authority to the beast. So they then come into alliance with the beast, and the beast then takes the ascendancy, and I think it's the beast who claims to be God, the other 10 kings that was not part of their pretense, but this beast that arises, who I think is the little horn in Daniel, becomes the primary protagonist that is called the beast here in this chapter. So it may very well be that the 10 kings are a coalition of Islamic kingdoms, and the beast then is someone who emerges, Rome, Egypt, Syria, Persia, someplace, and surprisingly amasses a great deal of power and becomes the most important power in the whole earth.
Yeah, when it says that the people won't be able to buy or sell or trade without the mark of a beast, is that literal or does it represent economic persecution?
Oh, I think it's at least literally economic persecution. You know, to what extent? I mean, it's hard to know the particulars and the details of that, but it's not at all far-fetched to think that it could be made illegal to do business with people such as us, and an attempt to completely marginalize us and completely put pressure on us to buckle under and conform and join the crowd. I mean, we're already getting that in our culture today. I mean, the idea that the whole idea of hate speech is a blank check to bring people into conformity. That is, if you don't share our values in the way that we want you to share our values, if you don't accept and tolerate what we want you to accept and tolerate, then we are going to label you a hater, and you know what haters deserve. And that we're already there, and you can just see that being magnified and enforced.
In paragraph 64, when he talks about the beast, now that's a person, right? And
When he talks about the, what'd you say?
The beast that performs.
Yes.
So we're assuming it's going to be a man. Where does he get this power to make fire come down out of heaven? I mean, is this a technological?
It could be, yeah. Okay. I mean, it would be very odd for God to actually, well, I mean, it's not impossible, but it would be very odd for God to actually credential the beast as the Messiah when he ain't. That would be very odd. So it says, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth. So imagine somebody developing a technology that would allow them to imitate and counterfeit a supernatural work from God. There would be an incredible deception.
Is he called a beast because we're referring back to the imagery, or is he called a beast because he's considered inhuman? He's like that debauched.
I don't think that's the point. Okay. I think the point of being a beast is that the beast has become a symbol for the instantiation of Satan's opposition to God's people and his purposes. So however that instantiates itself in a political and social phenomenon, that's a beast.
And the wound of the sword and has come to life. It sure sounds like someone tries to take this guy out and it looks like they succeeded, because instead of looking at it as the beast as a government or an era or a culture, he's being represented as a single individual person.
Well, yeah, unless that's a symbol of what later he's going to say. And I'm inclined to think that it's not an individual who's been slain with a sword. Now, it could be. I can't rule that out. But I'm inclined not to take it that way because of stuff that's going to come later in Revelation, where maybe when I look at it again, I'll change my mind. But my thinking so far is that the head that has been slain is interpreted as he was, he is not, but he is about to come again. And that it's some kind of revitalization of one of the heads of the beast. And it's just a way of describing his revitalization is, we thought he was dead, but now he's come back to life again.
Now, he has come back to life, or you think that's what it means?
Well, I don't mean that literally, because I think we're talking about a political entity.
Right.
So a political entity that looked like it had ceased to be a player at all in history, all of a sudden is the most important player in the whole world. Who is like the beast? Who can wage war against him? I mean, to go from 0 to 60 in the time that he's going to do it is going to be incredible. An incredible rise in power.
And in 65, he refers to free men and slaves. Do you think he literally meant slaves, or is he talking about the entire spectrum of humanity?
Well, I assume he's just talking about the entire spectrum of humanity, but...
Because he talks about trafficking in human souls,
yeah,
when he talks about Babylon the Great.
Yeah.
Kind of sounds like slavery.
And again, it sounds like today.
Yeah. 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 And on his ID being, not his ID being 600s, 610s, and 6, is that an allusion to Moses being told to break the people up into hundreds, tens? I mean, is there some sort of organizational
I don't think so.
Pattern there?
That's not the way I read it. I think it's just a device for promoting 6, 6, and 6. That's the way I'm reading it. Because how else are you going to do that in a number except 600s, 6, 10s, and 6?
But why hundreds? Why tens?
Well, what I'm saying is it could have been 6,006,600. That would have been fine, too. I think that's arbitrary is what I'm suggesting.
You think so?
I appreciate what you said about 6 not being 7. It falls short.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, liking numbers, thinking in three dimensions, in chapter 21, where it talks about the three-dimensionality of the measurements of New Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
Being 12,000 stadia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating that it's not just 7, it's 6 more than, 6. I appreciate that. I think we're speaking a much different language culturally, you and me, coming from probably two very different perspectives politically. And so I don't know what you mean exactly when you say things like, there are a certain class of people in America who want us to think a certain way. I do see legion of things that people want us to think and do, mostly money. Everybody's out for a buck. And then more recently you just said something to the effect of, and we see that today. It would help me to understand what you're saying if you could, and perhaps this is part of a larger conversation, if you could perhaps be specific about certain things like that.
Well, the most striking example today is the way in which all of the forces of elite culture are lined up to shame us into accepting homosexuality as valid. And they're just pulling out all the stops. Hollywood, the government, all kinds of policies that are coming down the road in the government, in the military, in the federal bureaucracy, the media, larger media, both right wing and left wing, everybody that you confront today, the value makers out there in the society are telling you that there's something desperately narrow and wrong with you if you don't simply accept homosexuality as perfectly valid. I mean, recently, Britain not too long ago, passed a civil unions bill. And I was just reading just last week that now that they have, is that the right word, civil unions? Now that they have the freedom to have all the privileges of marriage, all the civil privileges of marriage, that a married person has, now the pressure is on for them to allow gay marriage in Britain. Well, why is that? It's not a civil rights issue. They already gave them all the civil rights that anyone could ever want. Well, maybe not ever want, but all the civil rights that anyone else has. The only reason to press for marriage is for moral validation in the eyes of society. That's the only thing left to grant. And it's the one thing that someone who believes in a biblical worldview can't possibly grant. Now, if you reject the Bible, then fine, sure. Why stop there? But if you're taking biblical worldview and biblical message and the biblical gospel seriously, homosexuality is one. It's the only one, but it's one. Did I say the only one? It's not the only one. It's not the only one, but it's one of the dramatic ways in which moral depravity expresses itself. And the critical thing in understanding the biblical worldview is to understand moral depravity. And if we start taking evidence of moral depravity and calling it good, we are stripping the very foundations away from the whole biblical gospel and the whole biblical worldview. So if I am going to be someone who proclaims the gospel in the New Testament, I can't back down from and deny the biblical perspective on homosexuality as being a perversion among many sexual perversions that are destroying our culture and are marking our culture in various ways. And yet, it's becoming increasingly, the pressure is being placed on us in our culture more and more and more to just give up. Just stop. Just stop thinking like that. Just be tolerant. Just be accepting. I mean, it's always propounded in terms that we as Christians, in values that we would support. Respect other people, love other people, be kind to other people, be compassionate. No problem. That's exactly what we should do. We're not followers of Jesus if we don't. But what I don't even have permission to say of people who are doing something wicked, that's not wicked. How can I say that? I can't say that of myself. When I do wicked, I need to call it wicked. When I am unloving, I need to realize that that's a perversion of the humanity that God gave me. There's nothing good about it. But also, we mess up our sexuality out of our depravity. And when we see the evidence of people rebelling against the sexuality that God created and trying to create sexuality in their own desires, according to their own desires, that is rebellion against God. That's what we are all damned for. And I can't really hesitate but to call it what it is. But I predict that the day is coming where I will be thrown in prison for standing up here and saying what I'm saying right now. That is not unthinkable given the trajectory of our culture. And unless a reformation intervenes, a literal spiritual a spiritual transformation of our culture intervenes, I can see the trajectory, and that's where we're headed. I will be convicted of a hate crime, something like that, for just saying what I have said today. So that's what I'm talking about, because the whole elite class in America wants me to shut up.
But I'm looking at verse 66 in your translation. And I'm first struck
with... I'm sorry, verse what?
66, in part 22, the here's wisdom.
Oh, yes.
Which strikes me as quite literary level, quite dramatic from parts leading up. But that's not my question.
You mean it's this huge exclamation point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll get to my point.
Okay.
So my question is around the next sentence. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast... Trying to figure out how I'm to understand, calculate the number of the beast. Do you think that the message is know that your ultimate hope and like the day of rest, know that if you're deceived and confused, you will not move into that seventh day?
Yeah, it's mostly directed at the destiny of the beast, but the purpose of understanding that is that you don't throw in your lot with the beast.
Okay.
Because the end of the beast is going, its destiny is going to be your destiny. So you don't want to be on his side. And what is his destiny? Destruction. He will never make it to the rest.
Okay.
To the Sabbath rest.
Because I also wondered, it is calculate the number of the beast. Is there a sense that we're supposed to be able to figure out, like,
some of the earlier questions were wondering about, like, might the beast be, you know, the Catholic Church or I'm wondering how important in this.
Yeah, no, I don't think that, I don't think calculating the number is determining who the identity of the beast is.
Okay.
I don't think it's that at all.
Okay.
It's calculating the number is understanding the limits of the beast's authority, whoever it is.
Okay.
Whoever this beast ends up being, he has certain limits and boundaries on his authority, and he ain't going to make it into the millennium.
Okay.
So if you want to make it into the millennium, don't be on his side.
Okay.
That's essentially what...
That's helpful. And then just a little bit beyond that then, not so much based just on this verse, but in terms of what we're supposed to really understand through Revelations, how important do you think that John thinks it is that we do work on an accurate understanding of, for instance, like the political nature or the movements around the world, and like how important is it that we understand that versus
so are you asking how important is it to John that we be able to look at our present circumstances and predict ahead of time this is going to be this player and this is going to be this player and this is going to be the other player?
Yes, versus
I think not at all.
Okay.
Because as I say, where I am in history is going to, I'm only going to have the horizon that I have standing where I'm standing, and it's only when I really am at the end where I would even possibly be in a position to be able to make a good guess at who these players are, and that's the mistake that's been made over and over again throughout the history of the church interpreting Revelation, is we start by assuming we're in the end times, so. How do all these things line up? Well, I can't start there. I don't know if we're in the end time or not. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't surprise me on the one hand, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, people have reasonably thought that they were at the end of time for many throughout history. We may have thousands of years left before these events begin to transpire. So,
and in one thing that's I call good as a result of looking at this and studying this is I've started to identify like, oh, okay, you know, my daughter's health teacher is obviously not the beast, but it's good to be able to identify evil and want goodness.
Yeah, exactly. Just because I'm not the beast doesn't mean I'm not Antichrist. In the letter of John, he says, just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, and indeed many Antichrists have gone forth into the world, that the hostility to God and the purposes of God has been a constant throughout history. And the one thing that any spirit of Antichrist has in common with the beast is its opposition to the truth about God and what he stands for. So Bible teachers, health teachers, all kinds of teachers, professors, they can all be antichrist to the extent that they embody that spirit of rebellion against God and the things of God, the truth of God, that it is by its very nature antichrist. See, antichrist, the beast is not antichrist. Antichrist is a fiction of our popular understanding. The only time the word Antichrist is used in the Bible is in 1 John, and he's not talking about the beast. What he's talking about is what Jesus predicted when he was still among them. He said, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. Count on it. That's Antichrist. That's the spirit of Antichrist that he said, it's going to emerge immediately upon my death. People who oppose me are going to oppose you. And they are going to kill you, they are going to imprison you, they're going to persecute you, they're going to pursue you. So count on it, that's just going to be there. Well, Antichrist has been with us from the beginning. But the beast is a particular manifestation, a particular political entity, and a particular individual at the top of that political entity that is only one manifestation of Antichrist, but probably the most dramatic and important one in all of history. So some of us are just beast juniors. We're not the beast himself. Okay. Any other questions? We have 5 minutes. Let me just go a little bit further in the text then. Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion. This is 13:19, or 14:1, I guess. The Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice that I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who had not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. This seems to be, this is not an event, I don't think. This is one of those visions that are interjected throughout Revelation that are just a vision of some kind of truth, not a happening, not an event, but a truth. And what is the truth that he's trying to convey? With a false Messiah working in the land of Israel, deceiving the people and getting them to worship the beast, with the whole world worshiping the beast, nonetheless, there are going to be those who don't. And the those who don't among the Jews are the 144,000. Now, the reason I say this is not an event is because notice that you have the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. If I'm rightly understanding the chronology of Revelation, the Lamb ain't there yet. Jesus is not back yet. He has not come back at this point in the chronology. So I don't think this is literally the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. This is just a way of representing that these 144,000 who've been set aside as part of the flock of the Good Shepherd, their destiny is not to be destroyed with the beast. Their destiny is to be claimed by the Lamb. And I don't think he's saying anything more complicated than that. It talks about the heavenly voices singing a song, a new song that only the 144,000 could learn. I think the song is basically the gospel, the good news of the gospel. The 144,000, I don't believe the gospel yet at the point that we are in the chronology of Revelation, but that's their destiny. They are the only ones who are able to learn to sing the song. They will one day sing the song. They are not singing the song yet. It's the heavenly voices who are singing the song. But they will one day join them and sing it because they are the only ones who can learn it. And I think by the only ones, I think the only ones among the Jews who can learn it. Because we're going to see indications coming up that God has not stopped evangelizing the world throughout this time. So among the Jews, it's only those whom God has sealed with the seal of God on their forehead who are capable of learning this song. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women. I think all he means by that is he's talking about sexual purity as a symbol, I think, of spiritual purity. Because to talk about sexual purity in this context doesn't really make sense. I think what he's talking about is somebody who's not defiled themselves with women, who's been sexually faithful, is an analogy to being faithful to God. We're going to, in just a couple of chapters, we're going to have Babylon, the mother of harlots, the mother of whores. And I'm going to argue that that's unbelieving Judaism. Why whore? Because you have a whole minor prophet devoted to the relationship between Israel and God. God is like a husband who took for himself a woman who has done nothing but whore after other men. And unbelieving Judaism is that whore, is that harlot who has prostituted itself to the gods of the nations and have done anything except stay faithful to their own God. So I think the 144,000 are represented as not having defiled themselves with women, meaning they have remained faithful to their true God, their true husband. they've kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. That is, that's their destiny. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Not that they're unique in that. We are people who have been purchased as first fruits of God and to the Lamb. The whole idea of first fruits is just out of the field. If you harvest some of the field and take it and dedicate it to God and give it to God, that's what you were supposed to do with the first fruits of the harvest. So any human being who belongs to God is the first fruits of humanity. It's the elect, what Paul would call the elect, those people taken from among men that belong to God and have been given to God in a special way. That is, we're going to have a destiny eternally in the kingdom of God. Well, the 144,000 belong to that group of people who are the first fruits of God, to the Lamb. And no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. That sentence is so deep and so poignant. They are blameless. I think it's what Paul would call justified, or we have dikaiosune. Who are the people who have dikaiosune? Who are the people who at the judgment seat are going to receive a pardon and life rather than condemnation and death? If you are blameless, then that is your destiny, to be shown mercy. And what is it that characterizes them? No lie was found in their mouth. Unbelief always engages in deception and lie and untruth. We believe myths. We believe, we deceive ourselves. We tell ourselves lie. We don't have the courage to face into the truth about ourselves and other people and God and so on. It's almost it's the quintessential sin, is that we embrace lies and tell lies. Who is the one who's justified? The one who refuses to embrace lies and speak lies. So it's a very poignant kind of phrase in that it captures, I think, the essence of what makes the justified person justified, and the flip side of the coin, what makes the person who will go to damnation go to their damnation. It's because they are liars and propagators of lies and believers of lies, market in lies. Okay, I need to let you go.